Hi Rainmakers, Davinia here, and if you haven't already seen, my brand new book, Cash's Queen, is out now online and in all good bookstores. Cash's Queen was written exclusively for preteen and teenage girls, with a real emphasis on helping the next generation of young women establish positive money habits and achieve full mastery of their finances at an early age. As a mother of two young daughters, Cash's Queen was a real labour of love, and I hope will have a lasting impact on future generations by helping them tackle some of the financial inequalities that continue to plague us as women. Buy it for your daughters, your nieces, your goddaughters, your friends, and even yourselves. Link to find out more and buy your copy is in the show notes. Enjoy the episode. Hi, and welcome to the Let's Make It Rain podcast. I'm your host, Davinia Tomlinson. This podcast is for the rainmakers, those women who are breaking down walls, building their own empires, defying convention and rejecting stereotypes. Women who are unafraid to have open, honest conversations about money among friends and to share the truths we've been told to keep secret. Don't forget to subscribe, share, and download wherever you usually get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, then please leave us a 5-star review. Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of the Let's Make It Rain podcast. Today, I'm excited to be joined by one of the inspirations for the business that Raincheck has grown to become, and also one of the inspirations for my brand new book, Cash's Queen. It is my grandma, Rita. Why don't you say hello and introduce yourself for the benefit of the listeners?
Hello, my name is Rita.
So today we're going to have a very special conversation. The Rainmakers will know that I've talked quite extensively about the very positive female role models that I've had in my family growing up, not least our great matriarch. And so today what I'd like to get into are some of the different ways that having a solid grasp of our finances has been instrumental to our quality of life and has influenced the way that we view and manage our money as individuals within this family. So the first question that I have for you is around your experience as a young woman moving cross continents, so moving to a completely different country, completely different continent, not knowing anything about where you were going, and that sense of adventure. Can you share with us your experience as a 22-year-old woman moving to the UK for the first time?
Well, coming to the UK for the first time, it wasn't easy. As you said, it was like we was coming to the unknown. It was hard, but we persevered. And we had to jump through many, many obstacles to get where we are at this present time.
And I think something that you always shared with me was around how you came from an island, you know, coming from the Caribbean, and you came with, you know, a number of others who were looking to pursue job opportunities, to try and create a better quality of life for themselves and for the people that, you know, family members that you were leaving behind. Can you share with us what that was like? So did you always have a really clear focus that you were coming here to earn a living and to be able to support family members back home? What kind of thoughts did you have upon arrival?
Well, on arrival to the UK, I came with the intention of helping my family who are left in the Caribbean. It wasn't easy sending money back home and trying to make a living here, but we had to do it because of who we are and where we come from.
And can you describe, I mean, just to give a picture for people who maybe don't come from immigrant Caribbean backgrounds and families, as a young woman in the Caribbean, what kind of call did you receive from the UK? So at that time, you know, there was a very strong relationship that lots of Caribbean islands and so-called Commonwealth countries would have had with the UK, as it was known then, as a mother country. And where did you even begin to get the idea that coming to the UK might be a possibility or an option for you? Were there ads that were placed that were inviting you to come? How did you get the idea or the sense that there might be something for you here?
Well, as a young woman, and like every other young person in the Caribbean, the main object was coming here to work for a better living, because in our own country, it was just a menial work, menial jobs. Being a black woman, you couldn't get jobs. The jobs was always allocated to the English people that came over to your country. So we were glad for the opportunity to come to England, even though it was like we were coming to the unknown. We were glad to come so that we can form a better life for ourselves and our families.
And when you did come, what were your first impressions?
One of disappointment. Because we hadn't anticipated, we knew of the cold winter, the snow and the frost and everything, but coming directly into it, it was hard. And I just thought I wanted to go back to the Caribbean.
And what was it that made you stay?
Because we had no money to go back to the Caribbean. And we had to stay and work. Me personally, didn't put a figure or a number to say, like some people would say, I came here for 5 years. I didn't, because I just wanted to put my head down and knuckle down, because I knew what it was like in the Caribbean. So I wanted something better. And I just thought, you know, it will get better. And that's why I said.
And what sorts of job opportunities were you and your fellow islanders who'd come to this country, what sort of job opportunities were available to you at that time?
Well, because we thought, you know, coming from our background, we came here with, what would I say, no illusion at all, because some people would say I would go into nursing or study or whatever. But we didn't have that. I didn't think like that, because I knew that I had to help my family back home. So we went straight into the factories and work.
And you talk quite a lot about having responsibility for family members back home. And I think for lots of people listening, of course, there'll be those people that, you know, this idea and this concept will be completely familiar to them. Perhaps they come from similar immigrant backgrounds and families, whether it's the Caribbean or elsewhere, where they are accustomed to having responsibility for sending money back home. But I think for others, it's quite revealing to know that in addition to having to finance yourselves here in a completely foreign land where you don't have family support or anyone that you can lean on to help you, that you also bore responsibility for younger siblings, but also parents as well. Did that responsibility ever feel too great for you to bear? Did you ever feel overwhelmed by responsibility for having to earn a living and support yourself in this country as well as sending money back home too?
No, it didn't, because it's a thing that we as West Indian, that's the way we was brought up, and we just thought it was all not our responsibility but our duty to help where we can.
Yeah. So just thinking about, you know, obviously it's a podcast about women building wealth and, you know, transforming our financial futures and thinking about our relationship with money. And of course, lots of the women listening are also mothers, or they have some responsibility for children. Sometimes they're mothers, sometimes they're grandmothers, they could be godmothers, aunties. And for you, as somebody who, you know, as you described, sending money back home, you had lots of younger siblings, you are the eldest of 12, but you are also a mother of five, and you were a young mother. And in addition to being a mother, you were also working, as you described, in the factories. How were you able to budget? So alongside your husband, my granddad, how were you thinking about budgeting and making ends meet? So how were you making your money stretch?
Well, we learned from an early age to manage money, because when we were growing up, we come from an environment where money was not always available. And so we, at an early age, we were taught to manage on what you have, to cut your garment according to your cloth. Mm-hmm. So I had that instilled in me from an early age.
And practically speaking, what did that look like? So for example, I have very vivid memories growing up of this house in particular, the house in which we're recording this podcast, being a real hive of activity. You know, you've got five children, they've got their friends, but we come from a very big extended family and there were always people here. There was always an abundance of food. There was always a pot on the stove and you always found a way to feed the 5,000, clearly on a very limited budget. So if anybody's listening and thinking about some of the practical things that they could do to, you know, even if it involves, you know, stretching their grocery shopping across, you know, a number of different people, what sorts of things were you able to do to make sure that your family were always fed and everybody that came through these doors, whether they were friends, whether they were family members, they never left without full bellies?
Well, I'm a very family orientated and the type of person I am, I love to feed people and I love to see, it gives me pleasure and I get gratification from seeing people happy and giving. And sometimes I leave myself undone to feed my children, but I know that they were fed and watered.
I also have memories of when you would pick me up from school. So you would pick me up from school every day. And after school, sometimes we'd do things, we'd go and have treats. You know, I remember when McDonald's first came to the UK or when drive-thru was first introduced and we would sometimes go and I'd have a Happy Meal or we'd go and have an iced bun from the bakery or whatever. But another memory I have of that time is that we would go and buy in bulk. So we'd go to the cash and carry and we would buy sacks of rice, for example, or other household staples that would enable us to, you know, it would just mean that the pantry was always full because you are thinking about how, you know, it's a thing that nowadays people refer to as kind of batch cooking or meal planning and all of these sorts of things. But I think in those days, the idea, particularly for big immigrant families, of going to the cash and carry and trying to buy things on wholesale that could sustain a number of people over several weeks or months was something that was quite standard. Is that something that you think would have contributed to, you know, the way you were able to budget as well?
Yes, because to buy in bulk, you made the sacrifice. You have to make sacrifices in life. And you made the sacrifice and you know, well, then if I've got a certain amount of money and I would buy what I need in bulk, it means that instead of going to the supermarket every week, it means that I've already got it there. So what I would spend in the supermarket, I would save that to go and buy in bulk again.
Mm-hmm.
So
piggybacking off this point around how the way we used to shop then and thinking about rather than, you know, making this trade-off between going to the supermarket versus going to the cash and carry, for example, you've described a time which some people will be familiar with, perhaps if they have conversations with grandparents or their parents, where you would be paid on a weekly basis and be paid in cash. And you described a scenario in which you were at times able, if you were shopping locally, but at the local grocer, I guess baker, butcher, whatever it was. And if you were short of money, you'd be able to put it on the slate. Can you describe for us what that means and the consequences were for you in the short term, at least, of that situation and how you managed to get yourself out of it?
Well, that scenario was the worst scenario for me because go to work, wages were small, you were getting £6 a week. And at the time, the early stages of being in England, there wasn't a lot of supermarkets around. The local corner shop, you finish work at 6 o'clock, you come home, it's dark, and you go to the local corner shop and you buy what you want. And sometimes you didn't have enough money, you pick up the stuff, and to pay for it, you didn't have enough, and the proprietor would say, it's okay, pay me next week. Because you know, well, then this become like not a regular thing, but it just went on for a little while. Because you know you didn't have to pay the direct money straight away, you pick up things that you really, if you had the money in cash, you wouldn't pick it up because you know, well, then I didn't have enough to pay for it. But then at a point where I just come together and thought, I was working for £6 a week, paying out my bills and whatever, and I owe the supermarket £6. So I thought, no, this just can't do. So the one I saved up and paid the supermarket the £6, and just start putting it on the slate.
Right. And I think, you know,
you put it into paragraph the way.
Yeah, no, I think, I mean, when I think about, you know, it's a perfect illustration, really, of how easy it can be at times for us, particularly, you know, we're in the midst of a cost of living crisis on a global scale. And I think it's easy for us to be tempted into what is arguably a debt situation. Effectively, you owe money. So you've taken the goods, you haven't paid for them yet, and you've still at some point have to pay that back. So exactly as you describe, you have to settle the slate. For us, you know, in modern times, it might be you have a credit card that you're putting things on with an intention to pay. For some of us, if we're paying the minimum amount of money rather than settling the full balance each time, then you accrue interest. I talk about it in Cash's Queen, thinking about the young ladies and some of the things that they are tempted by, which might include buy now, pay later, for example. And we've talked about when people are encouraged to buy things that, as you rightly say, you may not necessarily need. So if you had the money available at that time, you maybe would make a different decision. But because you think, oh, well, I don't have to pay for it straight away, whether it be a new coat, a new dress, new trainers, or whatever it is that young people have, all of these different things that they might want to buy. And if they don't have to pay for it straight away, they can put it on the equivalent of a slate and then pay for it down the line. But exactly as you describe, without you having a solid grasp of what might happen next, you can quite easily rack up a good amount of debt without realizing. So if you were earning £6 a week, but at the same time you owe £6, then you find yourself in a sticky situation quite quickly. So that's a really good example. And after that situation, I suppose, once you'd settled the bill, how did you manage that relationship in future? Were you always somebody then that was quite averse to taking debt in future or putting things on the slate? Or how did you manage that beyond that point?
No, as I said, I had to manage, cut my garment according to my cloth. Having to feed 5 children, I would go to the butchers because we had fresh meat. Butchers used to sell, not like it is now. And you could go into the butchers and you can get a breast of lamb or you can get pig's feet or whatever the case may be, and you make a meal out of it. So that put me in good stead. And because I had instilled in me from an early age that you cut your garment according to your cloth, I always remember that. So I never get myself in the difficulties of putting things on the slate again.
Yeah, I mean, I think sometimes, even if you are someone that is generally quite good at managing your money, I think for all of us, as part of the experience of learning how to manage our money, we need to make some of these mistakes so that we know what to avoid in future. And for you, if you had to say, you know, whether you were good at managing your money or not, would you describe yourself as someone that from an early age was naturally quite good at managing your money? Or were there lots of mistakes along the way that helped you to find your way?
Well, I made a lot of mistakes, of course. I mean, but you learn by your mistakes. But I help people. It gratifies me. It gives me gratification in helping people, not just my family, but other people as well. And one of the things that sticks in my memory is, as you said, when I used to pick you up from school, or I would carry things for other children, my grandchildren's friends, crisps and sweets and stuff like that. And I would share or give them. And one of the things that really gratified me as an old woman now, one of the young girls who is a young woman now, would tell her husband that when she was at school, I used to bring sweets and biscuits and stuff like that for her. And of course, you get gratification in knowing that as a young woman, she remembered those things when she was a child. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And I can probably remember the names of the people that you're referring to, definitely. So when you think about, you know, again, just coming back to your experience as someone, because, you know, I want everyone to put themselves in the frame of mind or to think back to when they were 22, if they're already older than 22, what it felt like to perhaps be finishing university. If you went to university, maybe you're just starting your first proper job, earning your first proper money. But to just put yourself in the mind of being 22 and being, you know, leaving behind everything that you've grown up knowing and venturing into the unknown. It's a big adventure, but it's also really daunting. But then to realize that actually, you know, there is so much that you've gained, and I'm sure that you could describe some of the things that you have gained over time, but there is a lot that you leave behind. There is a lot that you, you know, there's a big loss to be felt there as well. And one of the biggest losses is that kind of support network from family network, but also from institutions. And I think financial services would have looked quite different in the early 60s than it looks now in 2023. And particularly when we think about the access that immigrant communities would have had to banking services, for example, there was nothing in the way of, okay, well, you've got this bank account and it comes with an overdraft facility. Of course, there were other workarounds. You know, we've talked about the slate in the local grocers. But one of the innovations that sprung up within the Caribbean community was this idea of the partner hand. Can you describe for people that are unfamiliar with the partner hand what that is?
The partner hand, it was like, was it like a club?
Yeah, it's a bit like a credit union, isn't it?
Yes, yes. You get a group of people putting money together each week and getting some money back. And then if you have it like for 12 weeks, you know, that's 12 weeks. So if you pay £5 or whatever you can, £5 for 12 weeks or whatever, mm-hmm. when your turn comes, you would get, that is £60, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And so on. So when that 12 weeks finish now, you already get your £60. So then the next person's turn will get their £60 until the 12 weeks is up.
Mm-hmm.
And that really helps a lot.
Yeah. And so I think effectively, so for anybody listening, the partner hand is effectively, as we've described it, it's like, it's really a cooperative. So everybody will contribute an equal amount, as Mama Rita was saying, each week. So everybody would contribute £5. So let's say the duration is 12 weeks, as she described. It rotates and then you get your draw. And you will know that in the absence of any other options for you to be able to get a bulk, you know, a lump sum of cash, the partner hand was one of the ways that among the Black community, we were able to start to invest in assets, maybe start to maybe think about putting money together to buy homes and furnish those homes. Is that right?
Yeah.
And, you know, for a long time, given that, you know, I talk all the time about Raincheck, originally thinking about supporting women, trying to promote financial inclusion for those people, you know, 50% of the population who are not being adequately served by mainstream financial services. And of course, yes, women, as women in today's times, we have access to all of the same kinds of banking services as men do. But the lack of inclusion or the, you know, potential exclusion comes from how well we are targeted, how we are communicated to, the types of advice we are given. And so using that same parallel and thinking about, you know, as somebody coming from an immigrant community to this country, they're not going to be jumping for joy to try and give you access to mortgages or other types of loan arrangements so that you could buy your first home or support yourself in doing some of the bigger things that you might want to do. And if you're trying to scratch together a living and think about sending money back home as well, it would have been nigh on impossible without the support of your community in accumulating enough cash quickly enough to do some of the longer term things you want to do. So if you think about Raincheck being all about taking a long term view, investing, you know, not thinking about get rich quick schemes, but instead thinking about how you can build that long term wealth. Well, without being able to amass money in the first place, then it's nigh impossible to do that. So the partner hand was actually, you know, a brilliant way for those of us that come from these backgrounds to be able to accumulate that cash. And I think when you think about the roles that the people who were managing those partner hand, what kind of roles did they play within the community? Were they just regular people? Were they, who were they?
There were maybe people you work with or people you trusted and so on, because as you said, I mean, it was difficult to kind of integrate with the white people.
Mm-hmm.
They make it very hard for you to be integrated, to be a part of them. So you find that the black people stick together and do what they can to help each other.
Mm-hmm. So just changing tack slightly, and you've described how, again, thinking about, you know, I want everybody to really have a very vivid image of what that must have been like. So, I mean, the Caribbean can be viewed as a paradise today, but in those times, as a young woman who is ambitious, who wants to get on, who wants to improve her quality of life and just have solid employment, it would have been an incredibly challenging environment to grow up in. And so you come to the UK, as we've said repeatedly, it's, you know, a completely unknown environment. And the reception that you would have received, like lots of others, wouldn't necessarily have been as warm and welcoming as you thought. Can you?
22 as well. You're still a child. Well, a young woman.
Yeah. What was that like?
Well, it was intimidating. And you had, as I say, you had all sorts of obstacles. And it was like a monumentous mountain you had to climb, because the prejudice was so widespread that you kind of have to watch where you're walking, watch what you're doing, because you wasn't welcome. As I say, it was so difficult. That's why you find the black people congregate together, because there was no other way.
And from that, you know, that sense of community was really forged. You stick together because it's kind of, there's this idea of safety in numbers.
That's right.
And from that, you know, great things then arise, which would include things like the partner hand, where you are forced to support and uplift one another in order to achieve the things you want to achieve. But that brings me on to my next question, which is really around identity, because as someone that came to this country at 22, you've lived, I mean, it's not even more than half your life. You've lived 63 years in this country. Do you consider yourself British?
Well, we are British, but I'm a West Indian by birth. St. Kitts is my birth home, but England is my home. I lived in England for 63 years. So it would be naive of me to say anything other than that.
And then thinking about the next generation, so, you know, me as your eldest grandchild, and then all of your other grandchildren and even your children, what kinds of aspirations do you have or did you have for us when you were having settled yourself here, established roots? And as we've described, I mean, it's wild to think you've spent that length of time away from your home country. So the UK is very much your home. Birmingham is your home. What aspirations do you have for us?
The aspiration I had for my grandchildren was not to endure the hardship and the hard life that we had, because the opportunities is greater for them now than it was for us.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my aspiration. That's why I went, take this off of me. That's why I went and bought you the first computer for £800. You remember?
Yeah, I do.
I still got the receipt.
Yeah, I remember that computer. So thinking more broadly then, taking a step back and just reflecting on, as I say, you know, this podcast and all of the conversations I have with guests on here include our own relationships with money, some of the lessons we've learned along the way, but also what we intend to do with that wealth. You know, do we think of ourselves as wealthy, and what does wealth look like for us? And, you know, I always say, and I've shared with the Rainmakers on a number of occasions, that you are my number one role model when it comes to the idea of what we now refer to as self-care. It's not necessarily something that we would have described as self-care, but it was just in your way of being. You were somebody that always has wanted to invest in yourself, whether it be through your cake decorating classes, and you used to make those little sugar flower things, your swimming lessons, you used to do massage, you used to buy really beautiful skincare products, all of those things that have really influenced the way I think about myself and the way that I value myself and recognize that I am worth spending money on to feel good about myself. Where did that come from for you? So it's particularly given what you describe as you haven't had a particularly easy road to achieving the level of comfort that you have now, but yet you were always adamant that whatever, come what may, you were going to take the time out to invest in yourself. And also you were the first person I know. I mean, now on Instagram and across social media, it's a very popular and trending for women to be taking solo holidays and doing all of that. You were the first person that I knew in the family. In fact, probably still are, including myself, the only person, the only woman I know who has taken a solo holiday. Do you remember when you went to Ibiza? Mm-hmm. So where did that come from? Where did that self-conviction come from that you were worth investing in?
Because first of all, it's about love. And you have to love yourself, mm-hmm. to invest in yourself and think that you have got some self-worth.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't say because loving yourself is vanity. No, loving yourself, it gives you the confidence, because I didn't have the confidence, especially when I leave St. Kitts to come here. I was so timid. I didn't have the confidence to even have a conversation with a white person. Mm-hmm. So having that, to the question you ask, it just makes you feel good and make you feel like you are worth investing in, give you the self-worth and the confidence to love yourself more.
Mm. You know what's interesting about what you say? Because you described being timid when you came here, and yet you still had such inner steel that you were able to make the leap. You had no idea what you were going into. And I'm sure that there were many other timid people that were like, I'm not leaving my family because this is what I know. And you said, well, I am a bit timid, but I'm going anyway. Mm. How did you cultivate over time? How did you develop then that kind of strength of character and that resilience over time to withstand some of the conditions that you confronted? What tips would you have for anybody else that feels a little bit unsure about taking a leap into the unknown?
Well, the first thing, you have to believe in yourself and believe in God. And, you know, we can't do anything without God. And he gives you the confidence, and he is guiding you and walking with you all the time. And you learn as I say, I was 22 and I was still learning. And now I've got so much confidence now that I can go in and speak to anybody. Maybe I don't get it out in the correct way, but they can make a sentence out of what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
So I've learned a lot in the 63 years I'm here.
And what advice would you give to a young woman then about managing her money? If you had to say, you know, as a principle, and you've touched on one because you've said it a few times, and it's actually one of the chapters in my book, which is Cut Your Cloth According to Your Size. You described it as... Did you say
cut your garment?
Yeah.
Cut your garment according to your cloth?
Right, exactly. But ultimately...
Say it meaning.
Exactly. So what advice would you give to a young woman about her money if you had to give her one top tip?
Well, it comes from the family, actually, because this comes from my grandma. She used to say, when you work, buy your clothes, save some and spend some.
Mm-hmm. I love that.
And we had that. That's where that inspiration, that's how I get my inspiration. And also making a meal out of nothing, really. We had to do that because when we were little, when we were at school, we used to get maybe a penny or a penny halfpenny for our lunch. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes what I used to do, as being the oldest, I used to get everybody's penny at me and go to the shop and buy whatever I can buy with that and make a meal.
So everybody gets a meal.
So everybody gets a meal and then we go back to school. So I learned that from an early age. I'll probably buy some salt mackerel and something and mix some cornmeal or whatever, or cook a meal. My mom's gone to work and sometimes she don't have any money or we don't have anything, but we would have like potato.
Mm-hmm.
Boiling the jacket,
mm-hmm.
with some salt mackerel or herring or whatever.
Yeah.
So that's where all that comes from at an early age.
Mm-hmm. Thinking about, you know, you've touched on it just then, I'm really interested in some of the other women that influenced you growing up. We come from a very matriarchal family, lots of very strong, powerful women. Who were the biggest influences on you growing up?
Well, My mother was a strong, powerful woman, but, you know, we didn't get any kind of influence from her. But we got it from my aunt and my grandmother.
And in what ways were they pivotal to the woman that you are now, would you say?
Through hard work and self-belief.
Mm.
Believe in yourself.
And I think lots of us, I'm sure there are lots of people listening that will have, that can certainly relate to, irrespective of ethnicity, that special relationship that girls can have with their grandmothers.
Mm.
And that was one that you've always described for us growing up. We would hear all the time of your relationship with your grandmother and what she was able to do for you when you were a young woman. So I suppose my final question then is around the relationship between money and happiness. And I think this is an age-old debate, you know, does money buy happiness? Of course, you've got people who've got millions and billions of pounds and are still unhappy. And then equally, you'll have people that have nothing and are still incredibly happy. I'm somebody that never likes to patronize those people that are completely impoverished, because I think sometimes it's disingenuous, particularly in the West, for us who have a relative abundant amount of wealth versus those people that live in still developing countries or what is known as the third world. And for us to suggest, oh, you know, they've got nothing, but they're still so happy. I think it's completely disrespectful. But that said, I do think that there is, you know, it's quite a nuanced debate. Where do you land in the conversation? Does money buy happiness?
First of all, you can't live without money.
Mm-hmm.
But money is not my number one be all and end all.
Mm-hmm.
But money certainly does not buy happiness.
And would you describe yourself as a wealthy woman now? So given all of your experiences today, everything that you've achieved, and even thinking about actually being somebody that has always had an interest in how you can take the money that you have and grow it. You've supported many of us in the family to do all sorts of things, setting up businesses, me, getting first computer, me. But, you know,
ridiculous to know a computer costs $800.
Yeah, and it was massive as well. But, you know, supporting us in being able to take holidays and travel and supporting us through education. So you've always taken that long-term strategic view and used the money that you had to accumulate more money through very clever investments. But of course, we know that wealth is comprised of so many other things besides just hard cash. You know, there's the emotional well-being and spiritual health and well-being. Of course, you've got a really strong relationship with God. Would you describe yourself as a wealthy woman overall?
Yes, because you don't have to have money. You need money to live, but you don't have to have the wealth of money. Because, I mean, you're going to die and leave it anyway.
Right. So your wealth is about more than just the money that you've accumulated. Completely agree. So thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I know you don't have a website or an Instagram or a Facebook that people can follow you at, but for anybody that is part of the Rainmakers Academy or in any way linked to Raincheck, they will already know and feel your influences, not least through my book, Cash is Queen. Lots of the lessons in there that I want to impart and share with the young ladies that are reading stem from conversations and experiences that I've had in the home. So thank you for your contribution. And to anybody listening, see you next episode. Hi everyone, Davinia here. I hope you've enjoyed today's episode. If any of what you heard resonated and you'd like to find out more about how Raincheck is helping women all over the world build sustainable long-term wealth, then visit our website at raincheck.com and join the mailing list for more commentary, tips, and opinion on how you can start taking steps to leveling up your financial well-being today. You can follow us on social media at Raincheck, and don't forget to share, like, rate, review, and subscribe. See you next time. We'll